Next speaker, Alex Harrison, has been a very dedicated Palestine activist for many years and was on the Gaza flotilla that was where the massacre happened. And Alex is going to...
I'm with the Free Gaza Movement and I support the flotilla. Unlike Nick, I don't have any pictures to show you. These are used to call our equipment, my computer, or my cameras. So they are the only ones in control of the evidence coming out. But like Nick, I'm also a member of the International Solidarity Movement. I was travelling to Gaza, or trying to travel to Gaza, to join the ISM group. That's down there. It's a very small group that's working with the farmers and in the buffer zone and with the fishermen and coming under live fire on a very regular basis. Most of those volunteers have been there for a very long time. The newest people in that group have been there since January. Some of the others have been there for a year now. And they don't want to leave until they're replaced. Unfortunately, it's very difficult for us to get in. So on the flotilla, you will have all by now heard about the killings on board the Mavi Marmara. You might not have heard what happened on the other ships. I was aboard the Samud, which was the smallest ship in the flotilla. When we sailed, we weren't expecting Israeli violence. I was also aboard the crew member last year aboard the Spirit of Humanity, another Free Gaza boat that was attacked and hijacked by the Israelis. So I was quite expecting that kind of Israeli reception, but I don't think, although we discussed every possibility, I don't think any of us really expected the hand-to-hand, the up-close violence we were subject to, because even if we were shot at very close range, I don't think we were expecting that. When we set sail to peacefully break the siege, not to see people killed. The flotilla was Free Gaza's ninth voyage, and the first that we've sailed in partnership with other organisations, the first 8 we sailed alone. I'll come back to that later. Free Gaza contributed 4 ships to this voyage. The Rachel Corrie, the cargo ship, suffered mechanical problems as soon as it left Ireland. Free Gaza, the wooden fishing boat, was denied permission to sail from Cyprus. We'd sailed every previous voyage from Cyprus. The Cypriot authorities who previously supported us told us that they were very sorry. This time they couldn't allow us to depart. They were under too much pressure, they said, from the Israelis. The other 2 boats, the Hayat and the Samud, sailed from Crete. They also suffered mysterious mechanical difficulties. So the 3 boats that we had on the water, different kinds of vessels, bought in different places, sailing from different places, different ages, all suffered serious mechanical problems, problems with their steering, problems with the bilge pumps, problems with their electrics. The Hayat and the Samud had some of the same problems at exactly the same point in the sea. It's very clear to us that the boats were sabotaged. We haven't publicly asserted it because we can't prove it. The boats were damaged. We can't prove who did it. So, as they now have, the Israelis now have the Samud, we haven't been able to take it into dry dock and inspect it, but it seems evident that that's what they did. Having been on the boat when it was sabotaged, when it was suffering all these problems, it was clear that the Israelis were going to try to stop the flotilla. They told the press, they'd announced publicly that they would stop us, and knowing that there were nearly 700 people aboard, and initially 10 vessels aboard, I thought that they would try to stop the flotilla by stopping us meeting. And when they tried to stop our boats, it seemed that that was their tactic. I didn't think that they would attack the Turkish passenger boat with such lethal force. The Hayat succumbed to the damage and had to go into Cyprus for emergency repairs and wasn't able to leave. The Samud stopped in northern Cyprus for emergency repairs, and we did get out and we did join the flotilla. And at that point, we felt like we'd achieved a victory. We stopped in the night. We met up with the other ships of the flotilla. They all put their lights on, lit up like black wall illuminations. Every captain radioed and greeted us. and we had a celebration. We thought, that's it, we've actually got past the biggest part of the Israeli effort to stop us. We even, the next morning, stopped and had a swim in the middle of the Mediterranean, literally in the middle of the Mediterranean. We were 60 miles from Cyprus, you know, couldn't see any land. It was incredible. The mood was absolutely jubilant. But because of the problems we'd had on our boat, which is a very small vessel, it was a 25-metre yacht, we had 25 people on board, and we knew it still had some weaknesses. So for their safety and comfort, we actually transferred some of our high-profile passengers, our politicians and our writers and some of our media, onto the Marmara and onto one of the cargo ships, thinking it would be safer for them there. Obviously, we were very, very wrong. The flotilla met about 50 miles south of Cyprus, and we sailed together on Sunday morning. It's 220 nautical miles from Gaza to Cyprus. We met about 50 miles off Cyprus and moved at the speed of the slowest vessel. At about 9 o'clock that night, a member of the crew, I was very briefly at the helm when our GPS went out. Now, GPS doesn't just drop out. You don't just lose signal in the middle of one of the busiest shipping areas in the world. This is the Mediterranean. This is a route that people, you know, sail on cruises. And the GPS went, and I knew from our experience last year that meant the Israeli operation against us had begun. Over the next couple of hours, we lost all our communications. They knocked out the satellite phones, the satellite feeds for the journalists. They interfered with our radio. The first we saw of them was 10 p.m. We saw five warships around us on the horizon, and I felt that it was very much like last year. Last year, we were just one little vessel, 28-meter vessel, 21 people on board. And even last year, we had six warships around us. So I wasn't too perturbed by seeing five around us, because this time we had six boats in the flotilla and 700 people. I thought it might actually just be a show of force and that they might back down. So the warships appeared. About midnight, we got the first radio contact. Some of the boats didn't speak to them. They did speak a lot of nonsense. They called all our boats. They named particular passengers. And they gave us their warning, their threat, which I remember very clearly because last year they repeated it every hour for 13 hours before they took us. So what they radioed was, this is the Israeli Navy. You are entering a blockaded area. The responsibility of your actions will be on captain and crew. To which our response was negative. We're going to Gaza. Their warning, their threat, was nonsense, not least because their blockade, their siege of Gaza is illegal. If it was legal, they would have power over Gaza territorial waters, which should go to 12 nautical miles. At this point, we were still over 100 nautical miles from Gaza, so absolute nonsense. And of course, we don't respect their authority anyway. They never threatened us with any particular course of action. They never warned us that they would use armed force against us. They had in the media said that they would use all means necessary to stop us. Now, their definition of the word necessary is clearly very different from mine. Last year, I was on a boat with 21 people. Six of those 21 were on the boat with me this year, when we were down to 17 by the time of the attack. They knew exactly who was on the boats. And last year they proved that the only force necessary to stop us was to surround us and board the boats with physical force, but not with weapons, hijack us and take us into port. Last year they proved that they didn't need to open fire with any kind of weapons. So that was clearly the only force necessary to stop us. The radio conversation went on for sort of between 12 and 1. Last year they kept us... They began radio contact at the same point, kept us up all night, and then didn't attack us until the middle of the next afternoon. I thought, well, I've learnt a bit. I'm not going to face the attack, sleep deprived. I'm going to go to bed. But my colleague took the first shift. But about 2:30, she woke me up and said, "They're coming. The warships are moving in. There were then two helicopters above." They hovered for about another hour. The warship was just getting slightly closer. At that point, there was no more contact on the radio, no more warnings, nothing to indicate what they were about to do. Because our vessel had steering problems and because our bilge pumps weren't working, we were taking on water and we had mechanical problems. And also because we were a yacht, which would be very vulnerable if it was hit. We were sailing close to the Marmara, maybe 50 metres away, less at some points. The reason we particularly feared being hit was on Frigaz's sixth voyage. We sailed the yacht, the Dignity, and that was checked in international waters by the Israelis, who rammed it three times. Just because the signature was so calm and because of the skill of the captain, the Dignity got into port in Lebanon before it sank and nobody was injured. But because we were on the same kind of vessel, we were very worried that we were vulnerable. So we were sailing right next to Smoot. Sorry, the Marmara. The Marmara was the Turkish passenger ship. Most of the passengers on board were Turkish, but not all of them. And because it was a mostly Muslim ship, they held Muslim prayers. So we heard the pre-dawn call to prayer. We saw some of the passengers on the upper deck praying. And in the seconds that finished, the Israeli warships that had got closer launched Zodiacs. Zodiacs are semi-inflatable speedboats. They stuff them. They're very small. Not even the length of them is not even the width of this room. They stuff them with 12 to 15 commandos, Israeli soldiers, clad in black, face masks, covered in weapons. They have the full weapons jacket on, guns, sound bombs, batons, clubs, in full military kit, dressed in black. So they launched the Zodiacs at us. And we saw 8 Zodiacs in the water. They seemed to be coming for us. And last year, for our little tiny vessel, they sent 6 Zodiacs for us there. So they seemed to be coming towards us. But as they approached, 6 of them sped around us and went towards the Marmara. 2 stayed with us. And 2 tried to attach to the side of the Marmara. Now, the Marmara is a passenger ship that had more than 500 people on board. It actually could have, its capacity was 1,000. It's a ship with 5 decks. It's a very big ship. So this tactic of sending 2 little inflatables to the side of it was quite puzzling. Most of the passengers were inside. From the Smoot, we had a very good view. I was on the flybridge of the Smoot, so the upper deck. And we were still maybe less than 50 metres away, so we could see and hear very clearly what was happening. They approached the Marmara firing. Now, I spent a lot of time in the West Bank. I was in there with the Intifada, it was with ISM. I spent a couple of years there in total. I can tell the difference by the sound of live fire, rubber-coated metal bullets, tear gas canisters. I would know by the sound what I was being fired at with. I don't think you can reasonably expect ordinary civilians and volunteers to recognise from a bang and a man pointing what looks like a gun at them what it is that they're being fired at with. Those weapons were fired at the passengers on the Smoot, on the Marmara, on the Zodiacs, before any Israelis got on board from the sea. The small number of Marmara passengers who were on the deck came under fire immediately the boats approached. From where I was, it seemed to be stun grenades, rubber-coated metal bullets, and tear gas. And the small number of passengers on the Marmara who were on the decks responded by hosing them down with water. That was the level of the resistance. This was the level of the big, scary resistance on the Marmara. These 2 small boats stayed fairly persistent on attaching to the side of the Marmara. We carried on sailing. We were a slightly faster vessel, so then we came around to the front of the Marmara. And as we got to the front of the Marmara, we saw and heard the helicopters descending onto the first helicopter coming onto their upper deck. As it came down, we heard the crack of live gunfire. Because they were so much higher than us, we couldn't see what had happened up there. So we radioed the captain and said, "What's happening? Should we stay with you for solidarity?" And he said, "We're being brutally attacked. Sail on and try to get the footage out," because he knew that we had journalists on board who were photographing it. They didn't know whether any of their images that they were transmitting were getting out at all, and they just thought it was important that we got the news out. and so he encouraged us to try and sail out of the telecoms blockade that they'd imposed. What he knew at that point, but didn't tell us, was that two of his passengers were already dead. He didn't tell us. He just told us to get the evidence out, and I think they were very brave people indeed on that boat. I don't want to spend any time refuting the Israeli allegations, because they're all clearly nonsense. I mean, at one point the Israelis said there were 40 Al-Qaeda members on board our boats. Now, if that was the case, would they really have sent us all home? Absolute nonsense. They have said that the passengers on the Marmara attacked them. I have to say, you know, we're civilians. And our boats were not found to be carrying anything offensive, no weapons. But we're civilians on pleasure craft. They were on a ferry, we were on a yacht, bobbing around in the middle of the Mediterranean, still 80 miles away from Gaza or Israel. I'd say, if we attack them, how on earth did their masked armed commandos get on our boats? Their allegations are absolute nonsense. It's true that a couple of the passengers on the Marmara disarmed the soldiers. Now, I think if they had violent intentions, once they had hold of the soldiers' guns, then they would have been in a position of power to express themselves violently. They didn't. They took away the guns, they threw away the bullets. I think that proves that they were not violent. Yes, some of the passengers did use broom handles, bits of railing, things to defend themselves. It's not what I would have done, but I think that's because I've seen a lot of Israeli violence, and also because I'm not very strong, and it just wouldn't have been sensible for me to do that. If I had been a strapping young man, I think that might well have been my instinct. It's very frightening to be attacked at sea. I think more so than when I've been invasions and things and demonstrations in the West Bank, because you're very isolated at sea at night. You're fully committed to the situation. You can't run away, you can't hide. Once you're there, there is nothing to do but deal with it. The closest thing I can imagine to it that would happen here is if you were driving down a country lane at night in the middle of nowhere, all by yourself, and then suddenly an armed masked man comes crashing through your windscreen. Which of us wouldn't pick up whatever was nearest to defend ourselves? I'd pick up a steering lock, I'd pick up whatever. That was what the men on the Marmara did. It's a very human reaction. Also, to put it in its legal context, we weren't resisting a lawful arrest here. This was a completely... this was a completely illegal, unjustified attack on civilians by a military. It was an act of war. It's very, very illegal. It's a crime against the peace. We were on boats flagged in Comoros Islands, Turkey, the US, and that flagging in those countries has the effect of making them effectively the territory of those countries when you're in international waters. So we had the same rights to defend ourselves as if we were attacked by the Israeli army here. If the Israeli army came onto the streets of London or to the streets of America or Comoros or Turkey or wherever the boat was flagged and attacked it, you would have a right defence with proportionate and similar force. So actually, the passengers on the Marmara legally had the right to return the aggression with live fire, with helicopters, with gunboats, with submarines, with everything that the Israelis used. A few broom handles and bits of metal were just not an attack, as far as I'm concerned. I think that was a legitimate and understandable self-defence. We sailed on for quite a while after their boat was attacked. It wasn't quite until daylight, but it was a good 40 minutes. And in the distance, we could see another helicopter coming down over another boat, so we knew the rest of the flotilla was being attacked, because we had speculated that they would just stop the Turkish passenger boat and perhaps let the cargo boat through, some way to try and save face for their publicity. But it became clear that everybody was under attack. We couldn't get anybody on the radio. The two Zodiacs that had stuck with us had peeled away. I think they have quite short range, and we left them behind. And we began to hope that perhaps we were going to be let through, that it would be their bizarre PR manoeuvre to try and separate us and say that the Muslim boat was stopped, but they let through the hippies, or whatever they call us. But after about 40 minutes, we saw another warship appear on the horizon ahead of us. That sped at us as though they were going to ram us, like they had done with the Dignity, the other yacht, and then swerved. And it did that three times and pulled away, only to launch the Zodiacs at us. At that point, we were all very calm. Six of the 17 of us had been on Spirit last year when it was hijacked. we thought we knew what to expect. Last time they came on with brute force, pushed us all around, tied us up, fairly unpleasant, and took us to prison. This time it was quite different. Before they even got aboard, the Zodiacs came round us and they opened fire before they came near. We were not offering any kind of physical resistance except to stand on the decks. 17 of us on board, aging from 26 to 80. We had four people over 60 on the boat. 10 of the 17 were women. We're very clearly not a threatening group. Two of the 17 were professional journalists who were not taking any role in it, so we actually really have 15 activists on the boat. Four of us from the crew were on the flybridge on the upper deck. On the lower deck, there were 11 passengers who just stood on the deck with their arms out like this. That was the only resistance they offered. And as the soldiers came, masks covered in weapons, they began firing rubber bullets, rubber-coated metal bullets, gas cans, flashbangs. They broke all the windows on the boat with what they were firing. Everybody on the lower decks was bruised very badly on their arms. You know, typical defensive injuries, putting their arms up like this in front of their faces. Everybody had bruises there. One girl was hit in the nose. Her nose was smashed and burned slightly. We think she was hit with a gas can. Because in the dark, it still wasn't quite daylight. And because it was at sea, because she bled so much into this darkness of the burn, we thought she'd been shot with a live round in the face. She just looked such a terrible mess, and that created a lot of panic and distress amongst the passengers. The level of violence was so unnecessary, it was cartoonish, and the soldiers came up on the boat screaming like they were going into battle, shouting abuse at us, firing unnecessarily. And when they got onto the upper deck, we identified the journalists. We shouted to them, these are professional journalists, don't touch them. It was Paul McGough and Kate Geraghty from the Sydney Morning Herald. And Kate said, "I'm Kate Geraghty, Sydney Morning Herald," and the four soldiers who came up onto the upper deck, one of them said, in a broad Australian accent, "We know exactly who you are," and then tasered her. Absolutely unnecessary. They didn't respect any laws or conventions. They certainly didn't respect journalists. We were all tackled and taken down into the room on the boat where we were held. The women who'd been on the lower deck were tackled onto the decks and held face down in the broken glass. A lot of them we could see had cuts and were bleeding on their faces because they'd just been pushed into the broken glass. They were all clipped with cable ties behind their backs. Two of them had masking tape put over their eyes, and then they were hooded, Guantanamo style, or Abergrave style. Absolutely unnecessary. And then we were all taken and tied up in a room. We were still between 60 and 80 miles away from Gaza at that point. I can't tell you exactly, because they'd taken away our GPS, and then we'd been sailing for an hour after the flotilla was taken. And I can tell you that it took us another six hours, to get into Ashdod. So that gives you an idea of how far away from Israeli waters we were when they attacked us. Absolutely, completely illegal. I didn't see all of the violence on the Marmara. I didn't see the killings. In fact, we didn't find out about them until the passengers from the Marmara came to the prison where they kept us, because they had us incommunicado. But the violence on our boat was pretty shocking. I lived in the West Bank for a couple of years, and I saw a lot of Israeli violence against Palestinians. I saw a lot of invasions and a lot of killing. Maybe for that reason, the violence on the boats isn't really what I remember. And maybe also, it's not right, but I can see that in their heads there would be a certain logic in the violence of the military attack, that they would think that was necessary. So it stands as a fact in my mind, and I don't really think about it, but has stuck with me, and what's upset me more since, is what's affected me is the degree of contempt and humiliation with which we were treated from after the military operation right until we were on the planes. And that's because it was so unnecessary, and that the hatred, the absolute hatred they had for it was utterly relentless. We didn't have one interaction with them where they treated us like human beings. I think that surprised me, because although I've seen it in Palestine, I think I've seen it for an hour at a time at a checkpoint, or you know, a couple of hours during an invasion. It was relentless. It was absolutely relentless, and it really showed me how sick and disturbed they are. And that's escalated massively in comparison with our trip last year. Last year they put us in an ordinary prison, and we were treated as ordinary prisoners. And once the military operation was over, it was like speaking to any other officials who were doing their job, and you know, not on your side. This year it was quite different. On the boat, they wouldn't let us go to the toilet. We had an 8-year-old man on board. They made him piss himself. When we did finally get to go to the toilet, they stood over us. Male soldiers stood over us and made us go in front of them. Then they got all our belongings, rifled through them, and looted them in front of us, bagged everything up. We were searched. They took everything from us. They didn't just take our electricals and our cameras and the evidence. They took all our luggage, and then, which we've never had back, as well as all our luggage. They then went over our persons and took everything unnecessary that we were wearing. They literally left me wearing shoes, trousers, and a t-shirt. They took away my shirt and my hat. I wasn't allowed to keep those. They took everything out of our pockets. And they hissed at us and jeered at us and insulted us relentlessly the whole time. They took away cigarettes from the smokers and then blew smoke in their faces. When we finally got into the port, we were met with a reception of literally thousands of jeering, screaming soldiers and people in civilian clothes. I'm not sure who they were. They might have been right-wing press, taking photographs of us. Now, it's illegal under the Geneva Conventions to parade prisoners to be photographed, but we were photographed against our will. We weren't allowed to walk off the boats. They carried us. Some of us they'd identified and carried one by one, four soldiers, taking a limb each. If we weren't bruised from the attack on the ship, we were bruised just from being held. We all had sort of handprints on our thighs and the tops of our arms, right, the way we were carried off. We weren't allowed to put our feet on the ground, and we were held there while the reception committee, the thousands of them, cheered the soldiers, screamed at us, and photographed us against our will. When the news, Sydney Morning Herald picked that up, realised that it was illegal and had the footage taken down, but I believe the first couple of days that was up on YouTube, and that was up to, you know, to lots of praise from the Zionists. They really enjoyed seeing us like that. When we got it onto the dock, into the reception area, we were searched again and again and again. Some of us were strip searched there on the dock up to a total of three times by different authorities. First by the police, by the soldiers on the boats, and then by the police, and then by the prison authorities, but all within a 10-metre stretch. Some of us, myself included, were held down and given an internal exam against our will. I think the journalists fared worse. Kate from the Sydney Morning Herald, as well as being given the full body cavity search, it's very thorough as well. I mean, I'm not just talking about the rubber glove treatment. Apart from the rubber glove treatment, they go between your toes, in your ears, they brush out your hair. Kate had a bridge in her mouth which was glued in. They pulled it out, even though it was glued in, to check that she hadn't hidden anything in the tooth. Now, if she had done that, how on earth would she have got it glued back in? It was just abusive, purely abusive. We then held incommunicado. We got to the prison. We were denied the legal rights that the Israeli system affords you. The consul did get to see some of us on the second or third day, but he didn't manage to see a lot of the passengers. Most of us were not given our phone call, and we didn't get proper access to our lawyers either. Now, under the Israeli law, it's illegal to deport you in under 72 hours. You can make a voluntary, unless you go voluntarily, you sign a waiver and you leave, you have a right in their system, because you don't respect their system, but you have a right in their system to stay for 72 hours to give you opportunity to contact a lawyer and to go before a judge. They denied us that as well. The Turks departed voluntarily, and the rest of us were going to stay in prison to to make sure that the Palestinians had all got home safely and the Arabs had all gone home safely and been released, they didn't give us that legal right. In prison, again, smokers were not all allowed their cigarettes. The guards blew smoke in the faces of some of the girls who smoked. They didn't give us a change of clothes. We were there for 3 days altogether, still in the same clothes that we'd been in from when we were taken. We were photographed against our will, abused, insulted, laughed at. At one point, they brought psychologists in, or counsellors, social workers, to say that they'd seen us. And even those people were insulting us. It was bizarre. I've never experienced much hatred as I did from those guards. I think they were exclusively recruited from settlers or something. It was that degree of hatred. They filmed us in our cells, in the toilets, in the showers. There were showers, but you know, you had to get naked on Israeli camera if you wanted to use those, so we generally decided not to. There were injured women. There were women who'd been treating the injured on the Marmara. Even they weren't necessarily given change of clothes. Some of them were walking around covered in the blood of the men that had been killed. One of the Turkish women had been with her husband on the boat when he was shot. He was a journalist. He was IHH's a press officer. He was shot in the forehead on the boat, and she was thrown into the cells with the rest of us and given no special treatment even after that. And after 36 hours, she'd been with him, stayed with his body on the boat. But even after 36 hours, they brought a photo that they'd just taken and threw it down and said, "Identify it." And he'd been shot in the face. And he'd been dead for 36 hours when they brought the photo. He was so bloated and distorted, she said she could only identify his lips, and that was all. And then she was put back in the cell, thrown back on the landings with everybody else, but no special treatment. They took headscarves from a lot of the women. Some of the Muslim women are walking around with towels or T-shirts and things on their heads because the Israelis have taken their headscarves away. I'm not a Muslim, but sometimes I tell the Israelis I am, and I cover my hair there, and they don't like that, so they took my hat from me. I had two hats, they took them both. After the Turks left, some of us said that we weren't going to leave. They lied to us and tricked us to get us out of the prison. Because we were very, very clear that we were going to physically resist because we knew there'd be people working for our legal rights on the outside. They brought in Israeli male prisoners with drug and alcohol addiction into the prison and said that we had to leave. And they assured us that we were being transferred to immigration detention, which is the proper place for us to have been, for us to be having our appeal with the system. After 6 hours in a prison van with no food, water or toilet facilities, having been told we were there for 30 minutes, we found ourselves in the cargo hold of the airport. When we got out, we had yet another reception committee of screaming, jeering, hissing soldiers who were shouting at us, getting in our faces and laughing at us. Again, the smokers weren't allowed their cigarettes. And immediately, as soon as we got out of the vans, they began pushing us around. We were the last group of 12 women at that point. They closed down the whole airport terminal for us, and it was full of literally hundreds of soldiers. They'd identified us as troublemakers, so they'd put us in a pen in the airport. We were penned in and surrounded by soldiers, but from our pen, we could see the male passengers being processed in very small groups. I saw four different individuals, one of them, Ken O'Keefe from London, Paul Larrady from the US, and Fairkra from Ireland, who's on my boat, and one other man, being beaten by the soldiers. No provocation, no physical provocation, certainly. I couldn't hear what was being said, but what happened time and time again was we'd see the man would be standing, the next thing we'd see two or three soldiers leap on them from behind, start beating them, hitting them, tackle them to the ground, then you'd see more soldiers jump and pile on. And then all the other soldiers would be standing around, screaming, jeering, encouraging it, and they'd close in around them so that we couldn't see, and the soldiers nearer to us would close in closer to us so that we couldn't get near. And on two occasions, they came into the women's pen, and one of the soldiers just jumped off a chair and jumped in and smacked women about the back of the head and knocked one of them over. Absolutely no provocation, purely abusive. And his colleagues, rather than telling him to stop, jumped on us and pushed us away so that we couldn't help the two girls that were being beaten. Absolutely unnecessary, purely abusive. But What upset me most there was their treatment of the Turkish injured men. We were held to last, so we saw even the injured men going through. You may have heard actually in the first few days there were reports that there were six people unaccounted for from the boats. The reason that occurred was because the Israelis just lied about who they had in hospital. There was a British man, Palestinian or British citizen, who was shot in the head. He's actually fine. Miraculously, he was hit with a small round here. He's got the scar, the jaw, the bullet exited through his mouth and he lost five teeth. But we knew he'd been shot in the head, so we knew he was not okay. But they told us that he'd made a voluntary departure and gone home. He was, of course, being held incommunicado in an Israeli hospital, and the same with five others. So everybody has now been accounted for. Obviously, there are nine dead. Sadly, two others who are critical, who will not survive. They're not expected to survive at all. They're in intensive care and will not come around. Everybody's now accounted for, but just absolutely unnecessary, Israel lied about who they had in their hospital, so we thought there were more people missing. So at the airport we saw the injured people come through. And these men, this was now Wednesday night, and we were also in the clothes that we'd been in since Sunday night, and saw the Turkish men coming through. A lot of them had a leg cut out of their trousers, or maybe the arm cut out of their top, and been cut out to treat their wounds. So Israel had attacked the boats, shot these men, abducted them, put them in prison, and they'd been seriously injured, and Israel hadn't even given them a change of clothes. They'd stolen all our possessions, all our luggage, all our clothes, and hadn't even given them clothes to change into. We were all, which is not pretty bad, in those of us who hadn't been injured, because we were just drenched in that kind of nasty adrenaline sweat that smells really strong. But these poor Turkish men who were injured, it was on Wednesday night, wearing their clothes from Sunday night, that were covered in blood in many cases, and blood that had been there for 3 days, and some of them had wounds that were still bleeding. I saw one of the men walking with a blood bag. I don't know if it was from a transfusion or it was a drain, but he was just made to walk across the terminal carrying it in his hand. What upset me most was I saw about a dozen men, one after another, hobble across the terminal with a bandaged foot. And I couldn't ask them, why did so many of them have a bandaged foot? I couldn't ask them what had happened, because if they spoke to anybody, or if any of us spoke to them, the Israelis beat the injured person for responding to us. We couldn't ask them. I later found out that they had these injuries on the tops of their feet from when the helicopter came down, and the troops came down from the helicopter on the Marmara, and they came down firing. These men were shot from above. Some of the men, the men who were killed were shot at close range, in the head and the chest. But a dozen of the men were shot, and there were 59 people shot. They were shot on the tops of the feet. The bullets were coming down this way. So these men, still in the same clothes, covered in sweat and blood and three-day-old blood, were being made to hobble across the terminal. And they weren't given a wheelchair or a pair of crutches. And if any of the other passengers stood up and tried to offer them an arm to lean on as they walked all the way across the terminal, 200 metres, that person was dragged away and smacked by the Israelis, again screaming and hissing. And the Israeli soldiers sat on the floor and laughed and sniggered and made every one of these Turkish men who'd been shot in the foot hobble and hop all the way across. Every one of them, one by one, was made to do that purely for the amusement, for the sick amusement of the Israeli soldiers. And it didn't even end there, actually. I mean, they lied to us about returning our luggage. I knew that was a lie. They told us that everything had been loaded onto the planes. I knew it hadn't been. But they couldn't stop themselves hurting us or insulting us at every opportunity. And the final insult, it's just childishly bizarre. The Turkish had sent planes to pick us up. They were sitting on the tarmac in Tel Aviv. We went on three planes. Tel Aviv, Ben Gurion Airport, refused them permission, the control tower there refused them permission to use the radios while they were in Tel Aviv. So they weren't allowed to use the radio network. The planes had to communicate on the crew's mobile phones. I mean, what earth is the practical benefit of that? There's none. There's no military advantage for Israel in doing that. It was just about being abusive and just about insulting us. And so the crew used their mobile phones. It's the abuse and the hatred and the humiliation that has the most lasting effect on me, I think, and much more so than the violence. But of course, all that we've gone through is not 1% of what Palestinians go through, and it's why we do what we do, because it's never going to be so bad for us. My husband's Palestinian. I married a Palestinian 5 years ago, and I spoke to him on the phone after I got back. Couldn't phone him when I was in prison. And he said, "Habibti, they stole your boat. They stole your possessions. Don't worry, they stole my country." It's a sort of black humour that gets Palestinians through these things. I suppose I should add to that, yes, they beat us up, they abducted us, and then they deported us, and they killed 9 of my colleagues. My husband's from Balata, I should say that they dispossessed half of his people, and since the beginning of the last intifada, nearly all of his friends have been injured, imprisoned, or killed. So yeah, what we went through was almost nothing. Yeah, and as British, American, European citizens, we have privileges that Palestinians don't, and that's why we do what we do. So we want to talk a little bit about the Free Gaza movement. Free Gaza first sailed to Gaza in 2008, but it formed in 2006. Those of you who follow the history of history will know that 2006 is before the time when people talk about Gaza being under siege. It's not. People talk about Gaza having been under siege since 2007, when democratically elected Hamas government took power over the Gaza Strip. Gaza's been under siege since 1967. The siege has tightened in the last few years, but make no mistake, that siege has been going on since 1967. It was under full occupation, including settler occupation, until 2005. It is still under occupation and under siege. The Israelis still control all the borders and all the airspace. Nothing gets in or out without them. We talk about the banned list of items that go over the border. Actually, until recently, there wasn't a banned list, but there was a permitted list with about 80 items on it. I don't know you, but there's probably more than 80 items just in my supermarket trolley. 80 items is no way to sustain a territory of 1.2 million people. And things that were not on the permitted list were things like dried fruit and lentils, and people were not getting adequate sustenance at all. So Free Gaza formed to break that siege. We first sailed in 2008. August 2008, Free Gaza took 2 wooden fishing boats and 42 passengers into the port of Gaza and became the first boat to sail into Gaza port since 1967. That was followed by 4 more successful voyages that year. Then Spirit of Humanity was turned back by the Israelis, was forced back by the Israelis at the start of the Castellet operation. Following that, during Castellet operation, the yacht, the Dignity, was rammed and later sank. And then last summer, we sailed again with the Spirit of Humanity, and we were hijacked, abducted into Israeli prison and deported. That stopped us? No. This time we organised, and from 2 years ago, being a group of 42 people with 2 wooden fishing boats, we brought in coalition partners, we brought in the Turkish aid organisation, IHH, the European Campaign to End Siege, shipped to Gaza, Greece, shipped to Gaza, Turkey, sorry, shipped to Gaza, Sweden, and the International Committee to Break the Siege. And we went back with, well, finally, met up 6 vessels and nearly 700 passengers. All of that is more remarkable because Free Gaza is not an NGO, it's not government funded, it's not even a group that existed before. It's a small group of activists, most of whom came from the ISM, but it's just a small group of committed direct action activists who said, "Well, this siege of Gaza is illegitimate and illegal, it only has authority if people give it that. We're going to ignore that authority and we're going to sail to Gaza." And that's what Free Gaza did. Free Gaza still doesn't have any paid staff. It's just we pay our captains. We don't even have an office now. We don't even have any physical premises. We're an international... We're based all over the world. We're a group of activists who come from Europe, Australia, North and South America, even India, got together and said, we're not respecting the authority of this, we're taking matters into our own hands and we're sailing. We haven't been deterred by what happened on the flotilla. Obviously very sad that 9 of our Turkish colleagues were killed, but we're not going to let that stop us. We're already organising to sail again. Hopefully our flotilla will go in late September, early October. We're not going to go with less than 10 vessels. We're hoping for an awful lot more. We've changed the strategy a little this time. This time our idea is to send boats from particular regions, particular countries. We're fundraising to send a boat specifically from the UK. The reason behind that thinking is that we think we'll be able to get more support in our home countries and therefore more pressure politically and more coverage in the media if we can sort of say that there's some ownership in our countries of that vessel. So we will be sending a passenger boat from the UK, probably a passenger boat with 40 or 50 people. We're working hard to fundraise for that now. That's my final pitch, actually. All I really want to say now is if you have particular skills and you would like to get involved, I'll be honest, your chances of getting on a boat are very small because we've had thousands of people asking to get on boats, but we really need support, possibly in terms of fundraising, but more I need people with good media experience, knowledge, skills, ideas. What we do doesn't get into the mainstream media, doesn't get into the BBC. There's pretty much a blackout on it, and yet everybody still knows. I need people who have real skills with independent media and can find a way, you know, creative ways of getting this story out to people. So if you'd like to get involved, also on the technical side with the website, media and website, great to hear from you.
Thanks for that. That was a really amazing talk.